Welcome. I'm your host, Paul DiRienzo. Early in February, the White House released its Nuclear Posture Review, a document that officially announced a new round in the nuclear arms race, bringing us even closer to nuclear conflict. The purpose of the review is to determine the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. security strategy. It is the primary document for telling the public exactly what the U.S. plans to do with its nuclear forces in the coming years. Joining me on the line is Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group. He's the director, and he has written extensively on this Trump administration nuclear posture review. And we want to talk, we're going to talk now a little bit about what that means as far as what the U.S. is going to do in the next few years when it comes to its nuclear weapons, and what that what's the harbinger? What does that bring us? What does it say about what the future is going to be? So welcome, Greg Mello, to our program.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. Glad to be here.
Yes. So let me begin by asking you about what is a nuclear posture review in detail, and what does it really what does it mean? What is the Trump administration saying to us, something different than has been said in the past?
A nuclear posture review is a kind of an overarching strategy document that lays out the purposes and considerations that the president hopes to use in establishing all aspects of nuclear policy, from when we would use nuclear weapons, what nuclear weapons the president wants to procure and maintain, and the sort of the theoretical basis for all of that. And it's usually kind of a little bit pie in the sky. President Obama wrote one in 2010, and it didn't turn out to be a terrific predictor of what actually happened later. President Bush wrote one in 2001, and which actually had the same shadow authors as more or less as the recent one. And it was extremely hawkish, but that most of that stuff never happened under George W. Bush. So, but Trump, the situation is different. And basically the overall picture, there's kind of a family of policy documents, of which this is one. So there is a national security strategy and a defense strategy. What is new is that Trump is returning to great power competition as the basis, the primary basis for U.S. strategy. And I say Trump, but really it's people around him, both the neoconservatives and the generals, which play a dual role of sort of modifying and softening in some cases, but it's kind of it's a Cold War type strategy, and this is the nuclear part of it.
What's interesting, and it's sort of another issue, but I can't help but think that we've been reading in the media about, you know, claims of collusion between the Trump administration, or at least the Trump campaign, and Russia. Now you're saying that Donald Trump, who's often portrayed as a friend of Russia, is in fact returning to a Cold War confrontation with Russia.
Yes, and I know this. I'm going to just toss this out. It's probably challenging to some of your listeners, but we don't see we're concerned that Russiagate is being used by deep state elements, a sort of a combination of hawks, to move Trump in the direction that we see in this nuclear posture review. We know who were the people who were the principal original authors of it, and they had a lot more terrible stuff in it than it finally ended up with. But the main thing about this nuclear posture review is that it's really all war all the time. There's no diplomacy in it. There's very little non-proliferation. It's about prevailing in a conflict against Russia and China. Mm-hmm. And that is new. That's the real new thing. And the details are, some of the details are bad, but the overall envelope in which the details are put is probably the most worrisome part.
Let me ask you, Greg, let's go back away and talk about yourself and the group that you're with, the Los Alamos Study Group. Where is, you're in New Mexico, Los Alamos, New Mexico. Why is that important, and both historically and currently, why is it important to know anything about Los Alamos?
Well, yes. Los Alamos, of course, was the small in financial terms, but large in scientific terms during the Manhattan Project. The two bombs in World War II were designed here. They were tested here in New Mexico. And New Mexico has more nuclear weapons, laboratory money, and more actual nuclear weapons than really any place else on the planet. So we have the two biggest nuclear labs in the U.S. and certainly in dollar terms in the world. And then a few miles from our office here, there's at least 2,000 nuclear weapons in a bunker just south of the Albuquerque airport runway.
I see. So Los Alamos plays a major role historically in the development of nuclear weapons. It was chosen. Actually, a nuclear scientist, the head of the Manhattan Project himself, Robert Oppenheimer, actually chose the location.
Yes, he loved it. He thought that without a beautiful place to go, that they wouldn't be able to recruit the talent that they needed at the time. It's not so beautiful now.
I see. Because of the waste that was generated by the development of these weapons, in part?
It's in part that. It's lousy architecture. It's honestly, it's climate change combined with mismanagement of the land, starting with the starting with the Hispanic sheep farming and then the cattle farming. It ruined the forest, and then it's burned. That's the thing. It has burned catastrophically twice since 2000, with the result that there's a kind of a lunar landscape around Los Alamos, which used to be a ponderosa pine forest. And of course, it's growing back in scrub. But anyway, it's now in a cycle where the ponderosa forest that existed there will never come back.
I see. I've heard it said that nuclear weapons are as devastating, in a sense, to the countries that develop them as to the countries that they're used against. That when you drop an atom bomb, a nuclear weapon on a country, you're dropping one on yourself in a lot of ways.
That's a very good point. And here in New Mexico, we sit at the bottom of nearly every socioeconomic index. Our politicians are completely seduced by the laboratories, and every time there's an economic development committee, the laboratories get the catbird seat on that, and the result of them suborning our democracy here in New Mexico is that it pulls the politics far to the right and glorifies the military, and we end up without taking the steps that are needed to lift up the state.
Mm-hmm. So coming to the present time, since at least, you know, as my understanding, since the late 1980s, early 1990s, there hasn't been much, if any, testing of nuclear weapons by either the United States or Russia. And what has been going on in this period of time when there seemed to have been a lull in this nuclear arms race in Los Alamos? What was happening there?
Yes, there's been a lull, certainly, in design of nuclear weapons, relative lull, but not in money, of course. It's just less efficiently spent. There was a bipartisan group in Congress that was able to stop George W. Bush's dramatic ideas about how to expand the arsenal and build lots of new weapons of mini nukes, earth penetrating nukes. And then when Obama was elected, he lost majority in what was it, the Senate there first? I remember it was the House. Anyway,
the Tea Party movement.
Yeah, the Tea Party in 2010. What was going to be a routine treaty with Russia turned out to be a very hard slog for the Obama administration. They had to promise the modernization and replacement of every single type of nuclear weapon that we have to get the New START treaty ratified in the Senate.
What is the START treaty, just in a nutshell, not going into too much detail, what does the START treaty determine?
Well, it kind of continued the bilateral inspection process. That was probably the most important thing. It had some extremely modest arms reductions. If you didn't count the special counting rules that made one bomber equal to one nuclear weapon, no matter how many weapons it carried. So it wasn't really a disarmament treaty. It was kind of more a let's still be into arms control. Let's work together and a little bit. Well,
and Russia comes over to us and we send experts over there and we actually look at what each country does. Right now, still, we're doing that.
Yes, correct. And it's very important.
Do Russian people, Russian agents or Russian physicists actually come to Los Alamos and walk through the place and take a tour of it every once in a while?
No, but they count the warheads. And so Los Alamos, you know, is a research laboratory, and there may still be interchanges between the labs, but if there are, they're very tamped down compared to the ones that were there under the Clinton administrations. There are still
So there was a time years ago under the Clinton administration when Russian physicists came and saw our facilities and we sent our scientists over there to see their facilities. But we
absolutely.
And we've
absolutely
come to we've come sort of to the end of those days.
We have because of the high levels of suspicion but returning to that other narrative,
Go right ahead.
The Obama administration ended up committing to this huge nuclear modernization program. That $1.2 trillion is the estimated cost today, and that includes the deployment, that includes maintaining existing weapons and replacing them with new ones and deploying them over the next 30 years. Now the Trump administration is building on that. They want to do most of that plus a couple of other things.
What does that mean? There's like the strategic triad. I mean, we learn about it. There's the missiles, the ground-based missiles, the submarine-launched missiles, the bombers that can fly over a country and drop a bomb. Do we still have a nuclear triad system? Do we still go by terms of like mutual assured destruction, where if you shoot at us, we'll destroy all of you, so that should keep the peace? Do we still do that kind of thing? Is there still containment, if that's what you call that?
Yes and no. So, yes, we have a triad, although I think kind of that a cruise missile that allows a lumbering old vulnerable bomber like the B-52 to stand off 500 miles from an enemy country and fire a stealthy cruise missile that can't be seen, that's really a very different delivery mode. So I'm kind of thinking maybe we have a quadriad, but it's not traditional to say that. But the point of saying that is that there's a lot of redundancy and different kinds of different
technology has moved on and new things have come and old things are passing out, whether we like it or not.
Yes. And let's see, so mutual assured destruction. Yes, that's still there, but it's kind of a PR theme in a way, because the military is unable to think of any kind of weapon. Nuclear weapon is it's an oxymoron, really, but they think of them as weapons, which means they think of using them in a conflict. So on the surface, yes, we have mutually assured destruction, but actually, they are planning to fight and win a nuclear war.
How is that possible? Because my understanding, and all you have to do is visit, you don't have to be a nuclear physicist to visit YouTube and watch videos of hydrogen bombs. I hear that's a misnomer. They're just an atom bomb with more punch to it. But let's say hydrogen bomb. You see them go off, and they can easily, one hydrogen bomb of the 1960s, 70s era could take out New York City with no trouble, and they got 100 of them aimed at any major city. So how could you fight a war under those circumstances? It sort of doesn't make sense.
Well, there's kind of a conceit that we would, let's say a war started out as a conventional war, and small forward-based nuclear weapons were used in the conventional war. The conceit is that it would stop there so that we would win. That's the conceit. And that's very much a part of the Trump NPR, and that is the single most dangerous thing in it.
That it's possible that if there, let's say there was a fight in North Korea and the U.S. troops were again trapped at the Chosin Reservoir, this time we'll drop the bomb. And that would open up armed troops.
Yes, basically. The idea is that the U.S. can never be defeated, and using nuclear weapons as a kind of weapon of last resort that would always be there to prevent defeat, no matter where we are fighting with our expeditionary forces all over the world, and because we're the exceptional country, we can't be defeated.
Now, I could think up all kinds of ways that could go terribly wrong. Maybe you could sum up in one or two ways that could go terribly wrong.
Sure. Other countries also may have the idea that they should not be defeated, especially if they are defending their homeland, as we now call it, their core territory. They will respond. And so then, because we don't want to lose face, or they don't want to lose face, then it escalates from there. Or there's misunderstandings, which are really inevitable in any war situation. You don't really know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. So they're using smaller bombs now. You said mini nukes, which seems like, you know, like military intelligence and jumbo shrimp. It makes about the same amount of sense to me. But what's a mini nuke supposed to be?
Well, this NPR has got a mini nuke in it, and namely, we would, and this would design work would take place at Los Alamos for this, and then the production would take place near Amarillo, Texas. Modification of a few submarine-launched ballistic missiles to have only the first stage, the atomic bomb stage, not the hydrogen bomb stage of the explosion, so that the explosion would be relatively small, let's say in the 5 to 10 kiloton range, say half the size of Hiroshima, this ballpark. And the idea is that such a ballistic missile could be fired from a forward position, from a stealthy platform, and could reach a target quickly. The problems, you know, you could list them. We'd run out of paper. How would, let's say, Russia or China know whether this was a so-called low-yield nuclear weapon, and why would that not trigger a far more massive response?
Right.
Or
is this madness, or is America feel strategically, and this might be a larger question than we can answer in 5 minutes here, does America feel pushed against the wall, or why are we thinking of this? Even in the coldest days of the Cold War, they were constantly on the phone trying to, you know, keep these conflicts from escalating, and now it seems like they're going out of their way the other direction.
That's a very perceptive question, and this NPR is, if you read it, you after an hour, you put it down and you say, you know, this is really all about American sense of weakness. They're very concerned about rising powers about Russia resuming a position of sovereignty in its sphere, China rising and possibly forming and allying with Russia and forming a more integrated Eurasian power, which would threaten U.S. hegemony. And there's a deep concern about that. It's at the core of the neoconservative credo, and they're looking for nuclear weapons to be a major element in combating that.
Okay. All right. That's amazing. I have to let that sink in with the listeners for a minute while we talk. In the last few minutes here, I wanted to bring up a technical point. There's a device called a plutonium pit, and they want to restart manufacturing. They're basically it seems to be also a euphemism for an atomic bomb. It's the trigger for an atomic bomb. Could you tell us a little bit about this desire to build more of these pits and where they're going to build them? Because I'm also concerned with the effect on the environment, because it seems that Rocky Flats, where they used to, Colorado, where they used to make them, they did a lot of bad things, and nobody really wants to do that anymore. But who's going to get stuck with it?
Exactly. That's so. Yes, a plutonium pit is a euphemism for an atomic bomb, with minus the high explosives that implode this pit. It's got fissile material, nearly all plutonium, and they were made at Rocky Flats at terrible health and environmental cost. Criminal activity was involved in to keep production going while the environment was getting wrecked. And people's lives are getting wrecked. So we haven't made very many, just 29 plutonium pits since 1989. So in the last 29 years, we've managed to make 29 of these things. Los Alamos has been assigned the job, but Los Alamos has kind of screwed it up. They kind of a money sink up there. And there's a lot of pressure now from Hawks to have a factory to make these things, because Russia has one. That's the main reason. Russia has a big factory for these things, so which their philosophy has been that they need to keep people employed, and their pits don't last very long because they're not made quite as well. Ours last a century. They do slowly degrade from their own radioactivity. But so we want today, actually, there's a new administrator for the agency that manages the warhead program, and she said that making pits is her highest priority. It will take a long time to set this up if they are successful. The two sites which are in competition for this are Los Alamos and the Savannah River site near Aiken, South Carolina.
Right. Right. We had Tom Carpenter on a couple of weeks ago talking about that. Very interesting. They were sort of connecting you guys. I thought we had thousands of these. Didn't they take the ones from the bombs that they decommissioned after the Cold War and after the Soviet Union had imploded and put them in a storage facility in Texas somewhere? Why are we needing to make more if we already have thousands of them?
Yes, exactly. We do have thousands of them. We have people don't realize how many nuclear weapons we have. Everyone with a pit, we have, you know, about 4,000 nuclear weapons all told, not including those that are in the retirement queue that are sitting around with pits. And then there's thousands that are being stored as a national security asset category over there near Amarillo again. And so we have lots of them. But of course, they're thinking long term, and they're thinking about what about after 2080, if you can believe it.
You want to keep this going for another 70 years.
Yeah,
I see. Well, let's wrap up. This is a fascinating story. We could go all day with this. Greg Mello, from the director of the Los Alamos Study Group. What can we do? I mean, the UN stepped forward, and a lot of countries, U.S. not one of them, signed an agreement to ban nuclear weapons. What can we do as citizens in a minute or two? And I know that's asking a lot.
Sure. Yeah. Well, if people have contacts and connections in other countries that might sign the ban treaty, that is certainly a wonderful thing to work on. Probably not, it's not the, not a lot of traction right here. Here, we have to stop these new weapons, the low-yield Trident weapon, the proposed ship-launched cruise missile that Trump wants, that Obama got rid of. That was a good thing Obama did. We have to stop an air-launched stealthy cruise missile. We want to cut the budget of all of this. And why are we investing so much in this? And the overall context, what we have to stop vilifying Russia. Russia has legitimate interests, and we can't make causing a new Cold War a democratic talking point. It's not going to work, I don't think, and it's very dangerous.
I see. Thank you very much, Greg Mello, for joining us. A very interesting conversation, and we'll have you on again as this story develops, I'm sure. Thank you very much again.